Órale pues, Razo. Welcome to Chicano Highlights. I am your host, Beto, Beto Man, and we have a very special guest here with us today, Mr. Hector Gonzalez from Rampart Records. How are you doing?
Doing fine. Thank you so much for having me here today at QUCR. Thank you, Beto Man.
Órale. And we're going to start off just a little bit with your background. ¿De dónde son tus padres?
They're from El Rosario, Michoacán, and my family came here. This is my father's family. My mother's family was from Arizona. She was actually born in Douglas, Arizona.
Oh, wow. Uh-huh. And what year did they get married?
I would say they got married like right before I was born in probably late 1952, maybe early 53, because I was born at the end. I was born in October of 53.
All right. And your brothers and sisters, how many?
I have four brothers, no sisters.
All right.
Half brothers. I'm the only one that has that was born from the same mother and father. The rest of my brothers are half brothers, or because we have the same mother but different fathers.
All right. And that's almost in every family nowadays, ¿verdad? So nothing new, carnal.
No, that's putting it lightly.
¿Verdad? And where did you go to school? Your high school.
I went to Bell High in the city of Bell on Bell Avenue. Isn't that interesting?
Uh-huh.
The city of Bell on Bell Avenue, and I went to Bell High School, and then before that I was at Nimitz Junior High School. Bell High School was one of the last high schools in the county of the Los Angeles Unified School District that had middle school and high school together.
Oh, really? Uh-huh.
So there were people that went there from the 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th, but had it a little better because we actually got to go to a middle school and then go to Bell High, so we weren't there as long as other people.
Oh, cool. And the majority there was?
Anglo. It was an Anglo community, and there wasn't very many Latinos. You know, the few Latinos that were there were kind of enlisting in the war efforts in Vietnam. So the few Chicanos that were there, I remember coming back in uniform. And yeah, it was basically an Anglo community. The city of Bell was kind of like Mayberry, USA.
Orale. Did they treat you any different?
You know, I never felt any racism while I was in school. I kind of fit in. You know, I was in the band. I played in the orchestra. And so I was never really out with the rest of the general population of the campus, because we were usually in the classroom learning our music. Because back in those days, the music departments and any of the art departments, including athletics, were very, very strong. So if you played in the orchestra, you were also required to do the musicals. So I did The Sound of Music, and I did Guys and Dolls.
Oh, wow.
And so that was, you know, that keeps you pretty busy, you know, because, you know, that's demanding, and you got a lot to deal with. And so there wasn't very much time for outside activities, you know, or getting involved with gangs or anything negative like that. It was always pretty much music.
All right. What year did you graduate high school?
I graduated in 1972, and then I went to LA City College, you know, to study music there. I had moved to Hollywood right shortly after getting out of high school because I wanted to pursue a career in the Hollywood entertainment industry. So LA City College was the college that was in that community right down the street from the Braille Institute.
Oh, wow.
In that area. Yeah, the Braille Institute, LA City College, and couple of other famous locations there. I think the original Palomar Ballroom, where Glenn Miller showcased his big band In the Mood, was located in that area.
All right. And being from L.A. and just going through that whole turbulent time, what do you remember?
Well, the Watts riots. The Watts riots had an effect on myself and also on people like Renny Flores, who lived actually south of me. I was on Broadway and 68th. Renny was on Broadway and 77th, which was by the 77th Police Department. When the Watts riots started in 1965, in summer of 1965, it was terrifying, you know, because I got to see how quickly the police, you know, started killing young African-American males that were like, in one case, my friend, I saw him, he had walked into a liquor store right across the street that had already been broken into, and he just happened to be walking by, and he goes, oh, let me go in there. And then as he was coming out, the cops caught him and shot him.
Mm.
And it was terrible. So, you know, everybody, I don't know in the case of Rennie, but I know that a lot of the area where I was at, you know, after the Watts riots, everybody moved in. That's where we ended up in the city of Bell.
All right. Did you graduate community college?
No, I didn't. I got an offer to work in television, and I had been playing with my group Eastside Connection, and 1980 the band broke up, and I wanted to take a little bit of a break. So I went to work in television, but about a year later, you know, musicians were, you know, like, we're born to play. If you're a musician and it's in your soul, you're born to play. So about a year after my band broke up and I had been already working in television, I was looking for an avenue and a way to get back into music. And at that time, my wife had started singing and my son had started playing drums. So we put together a family band in 1980 called Lava and the Hot Rocks. Her name was Miroslava, like the famous Russian-Mexican actress who worked with Mario Moreno Cantinflas and Jorge Negrete and Pedro Infante. And so her nickname, instead of calling her Miroslava, we would call her Lava. And kind of like James Brown in the Flames or Paul Revere in the Raiders or Eric Burden in the Animals, we decided to go with Lava and the Hot Rocks. So we became kind of like the Mexican Partridge Family, because my son was about 5 years old, and it was pretty much of a novelty to see a family band with such a young drummer.
Wow. When did you start playing the drums?
Well, actually, I'm a bass player. My son's a drummer. I'm That's a bass right. player. I started playing bass when I was at Nimitz Junior High School. There were a couple of teachers there. And I'm glad you asked me this question, because nobody's ever asked me this. There was a singer who was a drafting teacher who, according to the book by, I'm trying to think of the author right now, but I guess he was in a group called the Monterays. His name was Hector Aguilar. He was the drafting teacher at Nimitz Junior High School. And back in the day, he was the lead vocalist in a very famous group called the Monterays. And he hooked up with another teacher at Nimitz by the name of Ovo Akins. And Mr. Akins was the science teacher, and he played guitar. And they had a band. So when I got to Nimitz, and I was like in the B7, my first semester there, I was playing guitar. And they said to me, hey, you know what? We got too many guitar players, man. You know what we need? We need some bass players. You know, and I convinced my grandmother and my dad to go to a pawn shop that was on Eastern Avenue in the city of Bell Gardens. It was called Hirsch's Pawn Shop, and they bought me a bass guitar, and I was about 13 years old. It was exactly 50 years ago, and I've been playing bass ever since. You know, that kind of kicked it off for me as, you know, knowing that that was definitively the instrument, even though I still play guitar. You know, I wanted to play bass.
All right. And now we're going to jump into Rampart Records, and how did this fall into your lap?
Well, I wanted to make a record. You know, after I got out of high school, you know, I teamed up with Harry Scorzel. Harry had graduated a year before me. And Harry was a phenomenal musician. I had never in my life, even to this day, met anybody, well, at least at that age, that had that kind of education. The greatest violin player that ever lived was Jascha Heifetz. And Harry had studied with Heifetz's teacher, a guy by the name of Numi Fischer, who was a conductor of the Huntington Park Symphony. Harry exposed me and opened my eyes to things that I don't think I would have ever known. For example, they used to have the annual Chamber Music Festival. They used to have the annual Chamber Music Festival. And Harry had these compositions that were written for violin and guitar by Paganini. Niccolo Paganini, he was a famous Italian musician from the 1700s, and he was born a freak. He had one hand bigger than the other. So he could do these fingerings and these positions on the violin and things that other musicians couldn't do because he had this huge hand. And so his pieces were very difficult to play. So because I couldn't read music, Harry very lightly over the notes, the arpeggios, the dun 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 dun. He wrote the chords for me, and we just practiced them. He showed me how to do an arpeggio, and we went to do these music chamber festivals, and we started winning, because it wasn't too much stuff with violin and guitar. let alone anybody doing Paganini. And then for an encore, we would do Light My Fire by Jose Feliciano. And I had the intro of Light My Fire by Jose Feliciano down to the max. Like, it sounded like a Jose Feliciano. And Harry, again, being the brilliant musician that he was, could actually improvise and solo on the violin. So that kind of started it off for us together, and we formed a band, and we wanted to make a record, and we're talking about how did Rampart Records start. I went around asking people, hey, you know, like, who do I got to talk to make records? And they told me, well, you got to find this guy, Eddie Davis. I go, Eddie Davis? Who's that? And they told me, well, he's the godfather of East L.A., and he's the guy that makes records in Mexican groups like you and what you guys have. He's the first guy to... I couldn't find Eddie Bethelman. I looked everywhere. I looked in the Yellow Pages. I looked everywhere trying to find... And then finally, I met him. I met him by accident at a rehearsal with a group by the name of Mickey and the Mextecs, and I asked him for a business card. He said he didn't carry business cards, but he said I could find him in the Yellow Pages under record manufacturer, under Gordo Records or Gordo Enterprises. And I called him in 1976 to come and see my group, Vavoom, at the Occidental Center in downtown L.A. We had a great group. Kenny Roman was playing drums with us. Kenny was a legend. I mean, he recorded that first Tierra album. And I don't think there was, like, anybody that came, like, for where Kenny was coming from in terms of, like, his drum playing was very unique. He had a lot of musical personality. And so we recorded, you know, we went down and we played for Eddie, and he loved the band. He was in retirement and really didn't want to get back in the business again. But he was so turned on, Bethelman, when he heard us play. And he loved this. We had a lot of great vocalists in the band. So we had 4 or 5 part harmonies. We had a horn section. And, of course, the electric violin of the great Harry Scorzo. So there was no way that Eddie was going to turn this down. We were young. We were ready to go. And so we recorded a disco version of La Cucaracha. La Cucaracha, La Cucaracha. Except that Harry brought in Ernie Freeman's son, the great Motown arranger, worked with Quincy Jones, Arthur Freeman. And Arthur did all the arrangements, conducted the orchestra, and the record started taking off for us. It was released on Rampart Records, and it was right at the very beginning of disco. 1976 was right when the super single disco records were starting to happen. And we were dealing a lot with the Southern California Disc Jockeys Association. And those first 12-inch super singles, they made them at 45 RPM. And eventually the Southern California Disc Jockeys Association requested from all the record companies to stop making those super singles at 45 RPM and keep them at 33, because the DJs were getting confused and the speeds were coming in like it would sound like the Chipmunks, or it would sound like, oh, look, oh, God. You know, they just couldn't get it together until that was standardized. So I was really pretty much in the infancy. And then Bethelman, Billboard magazine, started a disco chart. So they actually were breaking records without any radio playing. It was happening on the discos. And lo and behold, by the time our second record came out, You're So Right For Me, we had made the national Billboard charts. And we were like in the top 30. And in some areas in New York, we were in the top 10. We came out on American Bandstand, Rate a Record. We got a higher rating than Bad Company. I mean, things were really starting to move. The band was really getting popular. We did a third recording that was called Frisco Disco. We did an album. And then in 1980, the band broke up. But I continued my relationship with Eddie Davis throughout the years. And I didn't realize that years later, in 1993, I believe, Eddie Davis died of cancer. And he left me his record company in his last will and testament. He didn't want to leave it to his family, because I think that back in the day, Bethelman, when he as an Anglo was working with, you know, Chicano bands, I think the family was kind of ribbing him and giving him a hard time. And I think he took it personally. You know, he was a restaurant owner, and when he went out on the road with Cannibal and the Headhunters, or he went out on the road with the Premieres and stuff, you know, he'd have to leave the restaurants in the care of his mother. And I don't think they really understood. I don't think they got it. Like, you know, what do you got these restaurants? What are you doing messing with these Mexican kids? You know, they really, really didn't get it. So he left it to me, and, you know, I ended up with the company. There wasn't any money. I mean, I think he had like a couple of hundred in his bank account, you know. And so I had to figure out what to do with the company. And luckily, you know, through hook or crook, you know, I finally got to the point, you know, where I had a pretty good, you know, groove licensing, Art LeBeau, Varese Sarabande Records, Warner Brothers, Universal. They all came to me, and I became the licensor, and they became the licensees. And in 2014, we got our first Grammy nomination, American Grammy nomination, in the category of Best Traditional Mexican Folk Album. And that was a really incredible accomplishment, because it kind of showed me that I was on the right track. You know, I kind of looked at it like Eddie Davis was in heaven, and he was smiling down on me and saying, you know what, I picked the right guy to run my record company, because I know that anybody else would have never done what I did. In other words, in terms of not only keeping the legacy of Chicano music alive for our gente and for future generations and scholars, but also keeping the record company active so that we didn't fall by the wayside, you know, and not really be able to benefit. So at some point, I got hit up by a major worldwide distributor, and now I'm signed to The Orchard, which is owned by Sony, and we're distributed in over 125 countries worldwide. And I recently signed with an agency in New York called Spirit Music Group, who specializes in shopping catalogs for film and television. So I've had a lot of good luck with them, you know, because that's what it takes, Beto, man. Unfortunately, we as Chicanos and as artists and as record company owners, you know, we don't have the keys to open the doors where those opportunities are. You know, you got to be represented by an agency that's a legit agency that's got some kind of stature. And Spirit Music Group represents everybody from Chaka Khan to Peter Townsend and The Who. I mean, this everybody from T-Rex to even Jim Henson's Muppet catalog is represented by Spirit Music Group. So I know that I'm in good hands. So far, they got me in the new Canadian film, Gridlocked. I'm in the new Netflix series, The Get Down. I'm in there three times with the song Frisco Disco. And a couple of other things just kind of like brewing. But
why do you think Eddie Davis left you the company?
Because he knew I was an honest man. And in order to run something like this, there has to be a certain level of honesty and integrity, because it encompasses, you know, royalties, other people's monies. And even though I don't handle that, you know, that's handled through BMI, you know, you still have to set things in motion to be able to create that income for everybody, from the writers to the publishers to the representatives. You know, Eddie wanted his legacy to live on, and I don't think, bottom line, Beto, man, that his family would have made the effort that I did, because he didn't want to be forgotten.
Right.
You know, and I think you know, the Grammy nomination kind of solidified that and put Rampart Records, you know, back on the map, you know. But so now there's a movie in the works, and that's what I'm a documentary on Rampart Records and a movie on Cannibal and the Headhunters.
Okay, so that takes me to this point. What bands did Eddie Davis record that you have in your vaults?
It started with the early West Coast African-American doo-wop groups in the early 60s. You know, he discovered people like Gaynell Hodge, who wrote Earth Angel by the Penguins, you know, Chick Carlton, Jesse Belvin, Barry White. So that was the early part of the catalog, is I have all this incredible West Coast doo-wop, very similar to today's battle between the East Coast and West Coast rap. It was pretty much like that back in the early 60s and the late 50s. There was the East Coast, West Coast doo-wop battles. And so I represent what is known as the West Coast East Side Sound. And that part of it is what started everything, was the Eddie Davis would take the money from his restaurants and would book a studio and bring in Bobby Gross, who was with the Rivingtons, who did a Papa Umau Mau, and acted as Eddie's musical director, and they would record all these incredible records at Capitol Records. Eddie was one of the first guys that got into Capitol Records. So today, the quality of those recordings really stands up because it was done so well to begin with, taking in consideration that it was all analog and there wasn't any multi-track recording. It was all kind of done live with the vocals married into the mix. So you had to have great mixers, you know. Capitol Records did a great job. So that's basically it. And then in the mid-60s, Eddie Davis met Billy Cardenas, and Billy introduced Eddie to the Chicano sound. And I think the first group that Eddie got involved with was the Salas Brothers. And the first record that he released by a Chicano group on Feral Records was Darling, Please Bring Your Love, which was done by the Phil and Harv. And then came the Romancers, and then came the Blendells and the Premiers, and it just kind of skyrocketed from there. A lot of the artists that Eddie was working with back in the day were basically high school students, you know. That's the most incredible story that I find about this Cannibal and the Headhunter thing. When that record took off and they were going to go on the Beatle tour, they were in high school. They were just little kids. And so he had to go to a Superior Court judge with his lawyer, Al Schlesinger, and get the parents of these kids from Cannibal and the Headhunters to sign over guardianship to Mr. Davis, with the promise to the judge that he would take a tutor, because, of course, you know, he had to pull him out of school. That's a pretty incredible story. And like, how do you go from rehearsing in a converted chicken coop on Murchison Street in the Ramona Garden housing projects to playing in front of 56,000 people at Shea Stadium with the Beatles? That is a movie. It should be a great movie. It's a true story, you know. I mean, it's something that I think needs to be told. So I've been kind of concentrating, Bethelman, on trying to get that movie done. And this is probably the closest that I've been so far. And I'm just kind of taking it one day at a time, but it feels good.
Now, I've noticed that a lot of, you know, different countries are taking notice and reproducing a lot of this music in Japan and Spain. Tell me a little bit about that.
I just cut a deal with, it's funny you mentioned Spain. There's a label there that I've been working with for a few years called Vampy Soul Records. The guy who owns it is Iñigo Pastor. And he's putting out vinyl box sets of 45 RPM singles, and he licensed about 10 songs that he's putting out that are hopefully be coming out. And Japan, I still have a lot of product in Japan through Shin Miyata. I'm in England right now. I just got a record called The East LA Story, or The East LA Sound, the Rampart Record Story, that has 26 tracks. And it's funny, Bethel, man, because that's the first release of all these various countries where they actually concentrated more on our African-American artists. And so that was, so yeah, the other countries are definitely starting to stand up and take notice, and I appreciate that.
Any new things on the horizon?
We've been concentrating our effort on two releases that are coming out. The legendary Little Willie G and Little Ray, back in the day, I'd say maybe early 70s, recorded an album that was never released. They had a band called God's Children. The window of opportunity for Eddie Davis had opened at Universal because of the success of El Chicano and Viva Tirado. And so Eddie had Little Willie G and Little Ray and other artists who were there at Universal trying to do these recordings, and I guess it was an issue between Little Ray and Little Willie G, and Little Ray left the group and threw everything into a turmoil, and so the album never got released. So we are reissuing that album for the first time. I think it's going to be a very historical and legendary album for people to hear Little Willie G and Little Ray in their prime. And then we have a box set coming out, an anniversary box set on the history of Rampart Records. It will include a 100-page biographical booklet, and the liner notes were written by a guy by the name of Don the Roadrunner Waller. And he used to work for Rolling Stone magazine, and he is an amazing writer. I mean, I'd known Eddie Davis pretty much my whole life. And after this guy did the liner notes, I read things about Eddie that I never even knew.
Wow.
That's how amazing the guy was. So we're really looking forward to that. And that will be coming out later this year. And the box set and the God's Children album with Little Willie G and Little Ray will be released on the same day.
Yeah. All right. Now, what would you tell the young Chicanitos, muchachos, chamacos, you know, about life, about the industry, about music? What would you tell them?
Dedication. You got to find something you really like. It doesn't matter whether it's music or, you know, building guitars, whatever, you know, whatever you want to do in life, you know, you got to have a dedication. And everything else just comes along. You know, the door opens and things just come along. I mean, when I got into television, I never expected to win an Emmy. When I got into music, I didn't expect to be nominated for Grammys, you know, and so forth and so forth. But those are the things that come from the efforts you put in when you're dedicated. And that's the most important thing. You know, most people settle for being good. You know, my son and I got to meet Steven Spielberg a few years ago when they were doing Amistad. And the guy that was shooting the documentaries for Spielberg introduced us to Steven Spielberg on the set. He told my son and I, he said, you know what the difference between good and the difference between great is? He said, it's attention to detail. And that's what a lot of people don't. They don't want to go the extra mile to give something the attention to detail that's going to take it from being good to being great. And I always tell people, why settle for being good? I mean, why settle for being good when you can be great? But see, that's not always that easy because you got to go that extra mile. You got to be willing to really dedicate yourself. And almost like, you know, my son, who was a child actor, you know, basically sacrificed his childhood. You have to give up something. We talked about Harry Scorsell being the great violin player that he was. Started studying violin when he was like 4 or 5 years old. So anybody that's great in whatever chosen profession, you know, a lot of times you'll find out later that a lot of those people sacrificed their childhood to be able to get to where they were. But the reward was they get there.
All right. Well, we want to thank you. That's going to do it for us. Gracias.
Thank you so much.
And you'll come back again, ¿verdad?
Anytime.
All right, Raza, that's going to do it for us. You've been listening to Chicano Highlights. I am the Beto Man, and we've been speaking with Hector Gonzalez from Rampart Records. We will see you hasta la próxima, Raza. Ay te guacho. Also, remember to tune in to Radio Aslan, KUCR 88.3 FM, simultaneously broadcasting on KUCR.org and podcasting on EastLAReview.com and ChicanoTexMex.com. Hasta la próxima.